I want to start by, first of all, underlining the crucial work done by civil society, and in particular, the International Network on Explosive Weapons, also known as INU, which has been at the forefront of advocacy for immediate action to prevent human suffering resulting from the use of UEPA. So I'm particularly pleased to have with me INU's coordinator, Laura Boyot, who has been one of civil society's strongest voices on this issue. Laura, this declaration is, of course, negotiated and endorsed by countries. What was and is the role of civil society in the process leading to its adoption?
Well, civil society has been very actively engaged on this issue for more than a decade now. So for a number of years leading up to the political declaration process. And I think a lot of our work, especially in the beginning, was about getting this issue onto the agenda, both internationally, but also nationally in our conversations with states, and really making the case that this required urgent attention. So in the early days in particular, our work was centered around documenting the impact of bombing and shelling on people and on civilians in particular, and of the consequences that this has on cities being torn apart, and showing what the problem is. So a lot of that involved doing research and data collection and communicating about the impacts. And I think, you know, sadly, over this period of time, we've seen countless examples of harm to civilians. We see it today in Ukraine, in Sudan, Ethiopia, Myanmar, but we're also seeing it in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and number of places across this period of time. And what we see is that whenever towns and cities are bombed, it is civilians that suffer the most. And so we've found this to be very much a pattern of harm. The context and the situations may change, but it's predictable. And we see very similar effects in different places. So in the early years, our coalition and our members worked predominantly to make the case of why this issue required urgent attention. And, you know, in that period of time, the uptake from states wasn't immediate. We were arguing that this isn't just an inevitable consequence of warfare, that when heavy explosive weapons are used, and we're talking here about aircraft bombs, rockets, artillery, weapons that have no place in town centres, and that they're a very risky choice because of their wide area effects. And if they're used, they're likely to cause harm. So making the case, it's a very predictable pattern of harm and it needs to stop.
And why does it matter to have civil society actively engaged?
Over the past few years, we've been very closely involved in the consultations around the political declaration, both in terms of providing input to the text so that it recognises and describes the humanitarian impacts, and that it guides actions to address these impacts in a variety of ways, including by placing limitations on the use of explosive weapons in populated areas. But we've also been very involved as well in encouraging a broad range of states to be active in these discussions and making it the case that this is an issue that's of global concern, something that all states should be caring about. And I think I'd add just another thing that we've tried to do throughout this process and that we'll continue to do throughout the implementation phase. And I think this is a particular area where civil society organisations have a real added value and why our engagement is so vital. And that is that we try and bring the lived experiences to the forefront in policy making. So by engaging survivors and by case studies and other work on, you know, demonstrating actual experiences of this on people. And we'll continue to do that through our explosive weapons monitoring project. We will continue to undertake research on civilian harm, but we'll also be monitoring implementation of the declaration and the changes that that's being brought about.
Many thanks, Laura, and I'm sure we'll be hearing lots from you going forward. So next with me, I have Dr. Irene Georgiou, who is a legal advisor at the Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit of the ICRC, and who will specifically help me look at the legal and policy perspectives. Irene, one of the questions that keeps getting brought up is, what does the declaration actually commit endorsing states to? And what would you say are the three key points? And how does the declaration relate or fit into the international humanitarian law framework?
Yeah, thanks a lot. Great questions. Let me turn them a bit around and start by saying that, as the name suggests, of course, this is a political instrument. It's not a treaty. So it doesn't aim to create new law or to reinterpret IHL. It aims to facilitate respect for IHL and to strengthen the protection of civilians through policy commitments and practical measures. So that is essentially how it relates to international humanitarian law, which means that if properly implemented, it can contribute significantly to alleviating civilian suffering and to strengthening respect for the law. Now, as a recap, IHL does not prohibit the use of explosive weapons in populated areas as such, but the use of these weapons is, of course, regulated by the rules and principles that govern the conduct of hostilities, like distinction, proportionality, and precautions. Now, because of their wide area impact and consequently the high chance of causing indiscriminate effects, it is objectively very difficult to use heavy explosive weapons in populated areas in compliance with IHL. That's an important point to keep in mind. During the negotiations of the declaration, this law versus policy and the question of how the declaration relates to IHL was heavily discussed. And some states assured that they will only use explosive weapons in populated areas in a lawful manner, but it's far from clear what that means in practice. It's very unclear how states interpret and apply IHL when it comes to the use of explosive weapons in populated areas. And while compliance with the law is, of course, very important and needs to be strengthened, in particular in populated areas or urban areas, even more, the question is how to do this practically. And the answer is through policy. And indeed, militaries often implement the law through policy. And policy clarifies the meaning of legal obligations. Policy translates legal obligations into concrete and practical measures. And of course, for its recipients, for the commanders, for the staff of the armed forces, policy is binding. So here are three ways that I would highlight in which the political declaration concretely complements and supports the implementation of IHL through its three key policy commitments. First, and the most famous one, obviously, states commit to restricting or refraining from the use of explosive weapons in populated areas where this use may be expected to cause civilian harm. And this is beyond doubt the core commitment of the declaration. Now, by curbing the use of heavy explosive weapons in populated areas in particular, states can significantly reduce the risk of civilian harm, but also the risk of committing a violation of IHL. And both IHL violations and civilian harm are very common results of the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, in particular, heavy explosive weapons. Also, IHL requires parties to take all feasible precautions in attack to avoid or minimize civilian harm, including when choosing weapons and tactics. So this means they must restrict or refrain from using explosive weapons in populated areas, not only when this use would be indiscriminate or disproportionate, this would in any case be unlawful, but also every time it is feasible to restrict or refrain from such use, and doing so would result in less civilian harm. The second key commitment, which also contributes to IHL compliance, is the commitment to take into account the indirect, or as we call them, reverberating effects of explosive weapons when planning and carrying out attacks, as long as these effects are reasonably foreseeable, and also to conduct what is called battle damage assessments after an attack and to identify lessons learned from attacks and military operations. Now, taking into account all reasonably foreseeable indirect effects that amount to civilian harm is in fact a legal requirement under IHL and the rule on proportionality. And battle damage assessments and lessons learned exercises allow the armed forces to better anticipate these effects in future attacks if they have documented them in the past and allow them to adapt their policy and practice accordingly. And this commitment is crucial in my view, because the reverberating effects of explosive weapons in populated areas are often overlooked and are insufficiently considered when planning and executing attacks. However, they are a major source of suffering for civilians, and this suffering is often long-term, especially when essential services like water, sanitation, electricity, healthcare are disrupted or even collapse as a result of bombing and shelling. And third key commitment, last one, is the commitment to collect and where possible to make public data on the direct and indirect effects on civilians of the use of explosive weapons in populated areas. And this is key for many reasons, but linked to IHL critically, because parties to conflict have an obligation to do everything possible to anticipate the effects of their attack. So the more we know about the effects of weapons and the harm they cause through collecting data on these effects, the more these effects will become reasonably foreseeable in the future, and therefore avoiding or at least mitigating them in future attacks becomes more feasible.
Last, but absolutely crucial in a conversation on a declaration that seeks to address strengthening the protection of civilians from the humanitarian consequences arising from the use of EWIPA, I have with me Aurélien Buffler, Chief of the Policy Advice and Planning Section of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or short, OCHA. Aurélien, your office deals with humanitarian crises across the globe. How do you expect and hope that the declaration will make a difference for people living in conflict-affected areas?
Thank you. Hi, Juliana, and thank you for your question. First, let me stress that the humanitarian needs have reached a all-time high. So has the number of displaced people by violence and conflict, refugees and ITPs. And the use of explosive weapons in populated areas is actually a major cause for that situation. Just think about Ukraine, Syria, Sudan, and other contexts. This is the cause of immense humanitarian suffering. Now, in context where parties to conflict have adopted some good practices and have decided to avoid the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, like in Afghanistan and Somalia, we've seen a very significant and rapid impact on the protection of civilians on the ground. The number of people killed and injured has dropped. So has the destruction of schools, hospitals, infrastructure like water network or electrical grid.
And do you expect the declaration to have a direct impact in the field today?
So now the declaration integrates these policies and good practices to prevent and respond more effectively to humanitarian suffering resulting from the use of EWIPA. So yes, I think if member states who sign the declaration remain true to their word, and I think they will, and if they take rapid measures to integrate in their policies and doctrine and practices provisions of the declaration, I think progress on the ground can be both rapid and